And I'm absolutely delighted to introduce tonight's speaker. Our paths have crossed in service work, and one of my favorite things about the rooms is learning about all the different connections we all have. And anytime he talks about anything, he just speaks with so much joy, and if you ever get a chance to ask him about the 12 concepts, you should. And with that, we have Ron M. tonight.
Thanks, Alex.
I didn't know anything, there was a concept till I became a GSR, and then I had to learn about concepts because they call me up to read about concepts. I mean, I just finished the steps, give me a break. I thank all of you for being here tonight. I need to let you know that if you want to rent an outfit like this, I got it for 2 hours tonight. And I have Depends on, so if I go over my 40 minutes, I'm going to be okay. Be patient. I want to start by telling you I'm overwhelmed with joy over the life I now have. I'm just filled with love and adoration for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and all of what you folks have done to keep it available to us. I thank Rebecca for asking me to come here tonight to share. This morning I took a moment to ask God to direct my words tonight and accompany me to a meeting. So I know he's here, and if you have a problem with anything I share, contact him. I'm not giving out my email address to anybody. Anyway. Let me share with you, and I'll start in the beginning, is that so you understand part of what I'm going to tell you about tonight is I'm going to set a basic. Number one, I am Polish, and so you can go back to your family and say, I heard a Polak talk tonight, and he had complete sentences. You can do that tonight. And then number two, I am Catholic, and so that's going to come up in the talk, and as Alec finally shared, you know, that you can have a higher power of your choice. That's the beauty of this program. I went through two of them before I found my God of my understanding. I wasn't always suffering from this disease. I lived in a household, and I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and I lived in a household where Dad was involved in the church, Mom had a choir in two churches, and she played the organ, and so I should not have really had a problem with my higher power. We even lived in the same building that the Catholic priest lived in. And I had a challenge with that once I started practicing. And Dad was a traveling salesman. And he would be gone all week, and I would be with my mom. And I precede this by telling you I had an older brother who passed away from spinal meningitis, and he was the love of my parents' life. He really was. He was a brilliant young man. This kid at 10 years old could take public transportation and deposit money in a bank for the church. And so my mother never dealt with that grief. I would make mistakes doing homework at night, and today they call it child abuse. Back then, that wasn't the case. And the words that she left me with were, you're never going to amount to anything, because I wasn't meeting her expectation as it related to my brother. Well, what occurred to me then in my life is that I tried to prove her wrong at the expense of my family. And you'll hear that as I share. It's amazing to me in this program, and also for me, I can be in a room with 100 people, and they're all happy, joyous, and free, and one of them said something I think is negative, and I'll focus on that one person and forget all about the 99. And I did that with Mom. I tried to gain her acceptance. And when we first got married, we lived out on a farm, and we did that so we could save money to buy a house. and we lived on a farm, and I worked nights on the farm, and we finally accumulated enough money to buy a little house in a town called Libertyville, Illinois. And we moved in there, and at that time, I was employed by Honeywell, Inc., and I, in my own wisdom, I was part of a management training program, and I asked if I could move into sales, and I was in human resources at the time. And they said, well, sure, we would love to have you in sales. And they gave me the keys to the company car and turned around and left. I had no training at all, none. So I go out there on these sales calls, and I assure you, I learned the meaning of rejection. I really did. They either didn't like me personally, or they knew I knew nothing about what I was selling, and they would let me know that. And I just hated getting up every morning. And then finally, I found a solution. It was alcohol. I got courage and could face the world if I drank. And early on, I became a daily drinker. And I want to share something with you, is that I took this job to earn more money, since we owned a house now, and I found out again that alcohol gave me courage, and I became a daily drinker. And what that involved was, in the morning, most people drive and have a cup, and there's coffee in it. In mine, I had red wine driving to work in the morning. And then I worked for a company, many of you in the room would have loved working for them, because they mandated that you take prospects out to lunch at lunchtime and that you tried to have them become customers. And I worked my heart off. I went to a restaurant regularly that had pitchers of martinis. And so I had a lot of prospects that by 2 o'clock in the afternoon didn't even know their names, let alone become a customer. And so I did that, and the rest of the day I drove down those busy, busy expressways in Chicago, and it would have been really awkward for me to lift up a bottle to drink to give me courage to make the next call. So what I did is I would pull over to the side of the road, and I'd pop the hood of my car, and I'd get out a straw, and I'd drink the vodka I had in my window washer. And that got me to the next appointment. And in addition to that, at night on the way home so I could unwind, I will tell you, I had the cleanest car in Honeywell because I went through a car wash every night. The blankets fell in the back. Nobody was there. Came to the other end, and I could drink all the way home. Through that and get all the way home. And then when I would get home, I'd do a little more unwinding. And on weekends, there was always beer in my hand, and in case you don't know, I know, is that the only time I stopped drinking was when I ran out or I blacked out. That was one of the two. So that knowing that I had a plan for that, I had a bottle. In the Midwest, we had water softeners. I had a bottle in a water softener. I had a bottle in the workshop. And I had a bottle underneath the seats of my car in a fire extinguisher holder, just for fear that I would never run out. Okay. Now, as you can tell, I moved very quickly into the use of a chemical, very quickly. And I'm going to quote something out of the big book as it relates to family disease. It engulfs all those whose lives touched or suffer. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, and wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. I was married, and I had 3 children, and as I used the chemical, I became somewhat irresponsible, and I'm going to share an example. My wife left me with the children, all 3, to babysit on a Saturday so she could visit her sister, who was ill in a hospital, and I drank myself to the point I passed out. My 10-year-old daughter fed the 2 other children and herself. She supervised them all day, and she put them to sleep. And my wife came in the front door, and I said, "Where in the hell have you been? You should have come home a lot sooner than this." And she said to me, "Ron, I was with my sister, as you know, and she died this afternoon at 2 o'clock. That's where I've been." I had no empathy for her, none at all. It was all about me. And then my children, as I read earlier, the blameless children. I had my son Paul on the bicycle, and he asked me to give him a ride on the bike, and I put him in the back seat, and he was affecting my drinking time. And so I took him out for a ride, and as we were driving, the bicycle abruptly stopped. And I got off, I looked around, there's nothing wrong. So I drove back home, and when I got home, my little son Paul limped into the house and told his mother that his foot hurt, and she took him to the hospital, and he had broken his foot in between the spokes on the bicycle. But he was too fearful of me to tell me, because my children did this every time they saw Dad. And my other son, James, I was indifferent towards him. I gave him the impression I didn't love him because I was so indifferent towards him. And I hated my daughter. And the reason why I hated my daughter is that she was always smiling and happy. That's why I disliked her. Beautiful, beautiful little girl, but I hated her. And then the effect at work, I was on a volunteer fire department for 10 years, and I responded to a call in the middle of the evening, and I was an engineer. I drove the rig, and I got in behind the wheel, and all the other firemen got off. They said, "We will not go on an emergency call with that guy," and they pointed to me. That was the first example that it snuck out of my house and was now in public. When I was working with Honeywell, one time I was at a conference, and the rooms we were in were built on a raft, a barge. And I was so drunk I missed the pathway going up, fell in the water, banged my head on the pathway going up. The very next morning after the emergency room, I put my sunglasses on in the bandage, and no one said a single word to me. No one. And why? Because if you're successful and you generate the profit and revenue and profit for a corporation, you can do a whole lot of stuff before they'll let you go. And there I was in that room. And we were out in Boston one time. We were at Anthony's Pier 4. It means nothing to anybody, but they have two chairs to either side as you ascend these steps. And I would pass out, and they put me on the chair, go up and eat with the customer, and come down, pick me up, and take me back to my room. No harm done. They were the world's greatest enablers. So I was on a skid row of success. I really was. And they promoted me to New Jersey from Illinois. And if you know anything about New Jersey, it's a culture of conflict. And I was drinking all the time. I was there daily when I was in Jersey. And I did such a good job there with my alcoholism and the way I reacted that I got another promotion. And they promoted me to corporate headquarters. But just prior to that, I have to tell you what happened to me is the alcohol quit working on me, and I started using dry goods. And as you all know about dry goods, it's very expensive. And you don't take them, get them, and take them legally. And so what I did is I was in a business profession that we designed fire alarms and burglar alarms, and I found a guy who would pay me a percent of a take. And since I would survey a person's house or a factory location, I knew where all of the good stuff was, and I would tell him. He would arrange to break in, and I would get a percent of that, and that's how I supported my use of drugs, because I didn't want to take it away from my family, and I didn't want Carol to know. So I take this promotion to Minneapolis, and I have to tell you at this time, I really have lost the right to life. I lost the ability to love, and I lost the ability to care. I couldn't break in and enter anymore in Minneapolis. I couldn't get high. I couldn't get sober. So my solution at that time was to commit suicide, because I knew no other solution. And so I'm driving my car down the road, and there's a bridge embankment, and I'm aiming right for it, and I get a blowout on the right tire, and it pulls me away onto the shoulder. Now, if you don't believe there's a God, let me tell you, he was with me that night. And I also tried it at a fire scene. I figured how cool it would be to be killed at a fire scene, and no one would say, Ron's the alcoholic who died. But they would drape a engine in darkness and put my coffin on top of it, and everybody would be so pleased, you know, that the firemen. Well, what happened was I planned to go underneath this whole three stories of wooden porches, and I was wanting them to collapse on me, and then I'd be dead, and I would get that wonderful funeral. Except God had another plan. As I proceeded to go under the porches, I slipped and fell backwards, and the porches came down. I couldn't even kill myself, you know. And please understand, at that point, I had no idea there was another solution to my disease. Then I went on a business convention that lasted 3 days. And if you've never, ever heard this before, let me tell you, it's the God's honest truth. I was the master of ceremonies presenting to 450 men, and I was completely blacked out. I couldn't tell you what happened during that whole 3 days, but I managed to be able to complete my function for 450 people. I landed at the airport in Chicago, Illinois, and I had no idea where I'd been. So I was looking for receipts or matchbooks, couldn't find a single one of them. I couldn't hire any human being that could fix this because it was internal. Okay, so the following Monday, let me go back. I asked Carol, you know, and she says, "How was the conference?" It was really great. Then I listened to try and find out. She didn't know where I was either. So I went into corporate headquarters on Monday, and the photographer said, which one of these pictures would you like to use to present the good times and good work you guys did in your conference? And he was the one that I found out where I had been. He said, you sales guys, you get to go out in these three-masted schooners in California, and we have to sit here and freeze in February. That's how I found out where I had been. And now I'm going to tell you what happened. I was so scared at that point. I asked God, please help me. And what had happened to me was that there was a secretary at the end of the hall, and I'll never forget this. Her boss presented us at a meeting 10 questions, thought-provoking questions. And somebody said, where did you get those from? I got them from my secretary, and she's an Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's how I found out she was an AA. And I brought her into my office, and I explained to her the situation. And she left my office, picked up the phone, and called my very first sponsor, Harvey. And Harvey met me that night. And he didn't ask me anything about what I did. He shared his experience, strength, and hope with me. And then he took me to his house at 11:30 at night and introduced me to his wife, who was in the program. And again, she did not question anything that I had been doing. And then Harvey was kind enough to take me to my first AA meeting. Let me tell you, I was really, really frightened. Because that pictured AA. Everybody wore trench coats and had rusty zippers. That was AA. Okay? And I wasn't that kind of guy. And so what had happened was we met a guy who was walking through the parking lot, and he had two bags. And my sponsor asked him, he said, Jim, what's in the bags? He says, it's Thursday, and it's the first Thursday of the month, and we get to drink wine. They're all laughing, and I am just so uptight, so really not wanting to be there. But when we went into the rooms, there was such unconditional love. They're all laughing. They were showing me that there is another side of this life that I had been living. And I didn't have to do it anymore. They were the living examples. And what was really, really of interest to me was that they said to me, "You're the most important person in the room." And they cared about me, but I couldn't care about them. I didn't love myself. How could I love somebody else, right? And so they just wanted me to keep coming back and stay sober to do that. I didn't know what I wanted from AA, but I did know what I want. I wanted a fix. I surely did. 30 days dry, my gums stopped bleeding, I had good bowel movements, and I decided I'm going to try this again. And I went and I drank, rented a motel room, canceled all my business appointments in Florida, and almost killed myself. I drank for the whole weekend. And I want to tell you, folks, when somebody tells you that this disease progresses when you don't use, believe them. Because I had to have proof, not just the words. And I came back to my group, and I didn't have the courage to pick up a white chip. And so what ended up really occurring was that, I'm going to read something out of the book. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. My sponsor recognized that in me, that I did not have a God and that I was at a turning point. And what he did, I came home from work and Carol would meet me at the door, my lovely wife, and she would kiss me, and I thought that was out of love. I learned later that was her detector to find out whether I drank or not. I stopped off on the way home from work and I bought a pint of whiskey and I was drinking it on the way home, and she said, "Are you going to call your sponsor?" I said, "Yes, I am." And so what I did was I went to my sponsor's house, and prior to this I did a lot of lying, and I lied to them that if Honeywell ever found out that I drank, I'd get fired. So I went to his house, and guess, in addition to Harvey and two men from my group, there was the social problems counselor from Honeywell. And he explained to all of them that Honeywell recognized alcoholism as an illness, not a disease. And so they got Carol and I into an outpatient treatment program. I went to one side and she went to the other. And I liked it so much I wore my three-piece suit and I wore my Honeywell badge so nobody could not see just how wonderful I had become. And we went to it, and we were there, and we had what we call Charitable Tuesdays. And that's where you put your knees next to your wife's knees, and you share the experience. And all I did was blame Carol and the kids for my alcoholism. My name was never mentioned. I just attacked her. And the next day I went to the nighttime session, and I was kicked out of the program after 3 weeks. And what had occurred to me was that prior to that, all I had to do was scan this for 6 weeks, and insurance would take care of it. Everything was fine. Remember I mentioned God? I hope you find him. God decided, "Nah, that's your game, buddy. You're getting kicked out of here." So I got home and I told Carol, because she couldn't make it to hers. She sprained her ankle that night and couldn't make it to the Al-Anon session. And I came in and I said, "Carol, Jean, the counselor, she called me a name. And since this is AA, I can only describe it this way. It was a rectum with a hole in it." And she called me that name, and that she told me I wasn't ready, and she kicked me out of the program. Carol was my enabler. I expected her to say, "Oh, that counselor, how could she do that?" I said, "She accused me of being an alcoholic." And Carol took pause, and she said to me, "Ron, I believe you are." And I lost my last enabler. I was left alone for the first time with my disease. All alone. And the next morning I went to work and I got into a meeting with, they had two guys. One was a hourly production social representative, and then the other was for the salaried people. And they knew that I got kicked out already, and what they decided was that I should go to inpatient treatment. And the other place was really grand. Actors and actresses went to the place where we were doing outpatient treatment. This was not. It was a monastery that nobody had taken care of. And it was 30 miles out of the Twin Cities. And I want to tell you that's where my life was saved, was at that treatment center. What I learned there was that it wasn't the fourth or the sixth drink that got me in trouble. It was the very first drink. I did not know that. I learned that I had a terminal disease, that if I were an alcoholic, that my disease was not reversible, and it was fatal. In a Saturday meeting, I learned there was no counselors there. I learned that my thought of being unique was not true. You see, I didn't want to approach anybody with what I had done when I was practicing being Catholic. The God of my understanding would not even want to talk to me if I applied the teachings of my church. When I was there, I heard all of the men sharing what they had done, and I realized, my God, you're not unique, Ron. You're alcoholic. And then what I determined I would do is that I would conclude that I was not harmful. The God of Alcoholics Anonymous was a forgiving God. I also learned there I had an 18-year-old roommate. And my 18-year-old roommate brought me back to God. And what he said to me was that, Ron, you've turned your will and your life over to the care of God, which is your third step. But you're lacking in faith. And it isn't as though you are not having faith or non-faith. It's the fact that where do you put your faith? Do you put your faith in possessions, power, alcohol, or God? And I was putting all my faith in alcohol, not God. And he was the one that gave me an understanding that I could change my faith direction and place it in God. While I was there, I packed up my bags, and I was at the sixth week, and I was getting ready to leave, and they said, where are you going? And I said, I'm leaving. I've completed everything. They said, no, at this treatment center, you have to do a fourth and a fifth step before you can go. And up until that point, I thought, why is everybody being so much against me? I'm not hurting anybody with my alcoholism. It's my problem. But that treatment center made Carol write a letter. And she wrote the letter, and in her letter she explained how many times I was dead drunk and she had to put Christmas together, all the kids' toys. And also how I had embarrassed her when people come to visit and I got drunk and went to bed and left her alone. I have a 4-page letter from Carol. And at that point, what had happened when I read that letter, I realized the impact I had on other people's lives. And then came time to finish that, and I thought I'd be done. They let me rest on that for a week, that fourth step. And I saw for the first time how unmanageable my life had become. Going to that treatment center, inpatient and outpatient, I couldn't see my, I knew I was powerless. I saw the unmanageability in my life with that. And I also saw the second step. And the second step being that I was insane in my behavior. So when they say practice the steps in the sequence that they're in, that's very true. So when I picked the person to give my fifth step to, there happened to be a Catholic priest there. And he was the chaplain. And the reason why I liked him so much, it was Easter time, and he stood up in front of his parishioners, and he said to them, I wish you all a very Merry Christmas. He was one of us. That's why he was in the treatment center, okay? And I loved the guy, and I did my fifth step with him, And early on, what I learned in the program, I told the guys all the medicines I had to take for high blood pressure, cholesterol, all that issue. When I finished my fifth step, my blood pressure went down to 140 over 70. When I entered the treatment center, it was 200 over 90. I want to share that with you because that's how powerful it is for you to do a good fourth and fifth step. And I slept for a day and a half, and I hadn't been sleeping before that. So I ended up doing my fifth step with the priest. And when I left that treatment center, and even today, my past has been a beautiful journey to qualify me to carry this message. It really is. We have a maintenance program that as long as we get a daily reprieve, as long as we keep our spiritual condition in good shape. I learned to love meetings because God speaks to me through you people. Not through clergy or otherwise. He speaks to me through you people. And working the program brought me back to me and that I became open-minded, willing, and honest. And I needed that. But then you would think, ah, that's great. Ron's done. Well, I found another addiction. I became a workaholic. I became a workaholic of the worst kind. And what I was doing was pursuing another false god, money and greed, and I put my faith in money, which means if you ever put your faith in money, it is your relationship with God. And so I was doing business turnarounds, and I spent a year away from my family in Arkansas, a year in Oregon, and 4.5 years in Tennessee, just pursuing money. And then, as I said, I was at the turning point again. And two of the guys in the program pulled me into a parking lot and said to me, Ron, you're lying to yourself about working in this program. You're falling asleep during the meetings and you're not participating. And so I had to go to the last agreement that I had and tell them I couldn't fulfill the requirement, handle the financial penalty, because I put my program in front of work and money. And then I want to say this, is that sometimes sober hurts. My daughter, her fiance was in Colorado, and he was earning money to go back to school. And Kara and Lisa had spent a week with him talking about where they'd live, kids they would have, and all of that. And 6 drunken kids in a car ran over him and killed him the week after that. It hurt me so bad. And remember I said I couldn't stand my daughter because she was always so happy. When we finished that phone call and Lisa hit the floor, there was no way I couldn't lay down next to her and try and console her for what had happened. And I learned to love her again through that, God working in my life. Such hurt, and the hurt was a hurt I had never ever experienced before. And the people in the program said, we can't take that away from you, we can help you through it, but we can't fix you. And so they did. They stood next to me for months while I cried over that. It was just a couple of years ago, I sold my business. And I was trying to figure out where I would put the lake house and how many boats I would have, pontoon for food and one for fishing. And that happened on January 3rd, 2022. February 10th, 2022, I was in tumor board meeting at Emory Hospital. My wife was there going to have 30% of her tongue removed. And what ultimately happened was because God saw to it that I would be free. Carol went into surgery on February 22nd, 30 days later, and they had to remove all of her tongue, inside of her gums, and part of her throat. And what I considered there with Carol was that, number one, she didn't divorce me while I was out there practicing. Number two, she sat there with 3 kids with flu and everything else while I was in hotels, eating fine dinners, and flying around the country. And my friends would say to me, why don't you get a caretaker for her? And I said, with everything that Carol did with those kids and putting up while I was gone, she never asked for a caretaker. So I have a new nickname now. It's Chef Ron, because I feed my wife through her feeding tube. She can't eat anything through her mouth. And in addition to that, her meds are also. So I know what I'm doing for my retirement, 7 days a week, and I could never find a caretaker. And the reason I can is, you know, I've been with Carol in January, it'll be 60 years. And she's been there for me, and it's time there for me to be with her. She can't speak well, because when you replace your tongue with flaps to your thigh, if you talk, you will see how your tongue moves, and you need it. So she can't do that, so I pick words out of context. And so stuff like that happens. If I were still practicing, God forbid, I know how I would handle this. The other folks that I have dealt with and helped with and make amends to, I used to have good and bad experiences. And because I have faith now, I just have experiences. And I shared with you that I wasn't showing any love for my son, James. And I started sponsoring young people. And guys at 8111 would tell me, what the hell are you doing with these kids? I'm sick and tired of hearing them leaving their lunches in the school bus. And I said, how many times have you left your attaché case in a cab? So they changed standards, that you had to be 35 years of age or older to the meeting I was bringing them to. God bless alcoholics. And I didn't know why I was with these kids. Well, my son got picked up for dealing with drugs in Athens, Tennessee, and the judge said to him, I'll give you two choices. One, you can go to Crowbar Hotel, or you can go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I knew why I was sponsoring those young people. They surrounded him and kept him sober. My other son, Paul, his wife is bipolar, and I met a doctor here in the rooms who took care of my daughter-in-law and her bipolar disease, and also helped my son, God working in these rooms. And at Men's Workshop, I learned how to treat my wife. You treat her as a friend, not a hostage. And so they would teach me how to help her. I would come home and say, where's my dinner? You know, I didn't want to hear where she had been. Well, they taught me that you can wash dishes, you can vacuum, and you can make beds, and you can do things like that. Treat her as you would a sponsee or a friend. And that's why we're married 60 years. Okay. And again, it's Alcoholics Anonymous that has done that. And the amends, number one, I had to make amends to my father. And mother is that I was traveling back and forth when I was doing turnarounds and not stopping off to see them in Chicago. So I took care of my dad the last 8 weeks of his life. I couldn't see putting a stranger in there. Number two, with my mother, we brought her into our house because she couldn't live without my dad. And she passed away in my house. And then as far as my children were concerned, I didn't tell you this, but trying to meet my mother's expectations, I moved my family 6 times. They had a new schools, new friends, and everything else. My amends to them was I stopped moving them. And then for Carol, I shared my story. I am her caretaker today and will be. And then I'm going to close on this. I came to AA to stop drinking. And what I received was a way to live, and a life that's filled with new freedom and new happiness. I would rate myself as moderately successful. My stock of material things, that isn't great. But I know this. I have friendship, courage, fellowship, self-assurance, and an ability to be able to measure my skills, which I didn't have before. And then, above all, my greatest blessing is to be lifted from me from the alcoholic scrap heap, and that's a gracious God. And he's shown me love for others is more important than a pursuit of riches. And from serving them and being able to be lifted and have this trust through service work and keeping the program going as a GSR division leader, discussion leader, hotline speaker, workshop participant, most important through sponsorship, who better qualified to help save men's lives but us and women's lives. And we're giving hope to the newcomer. So through sobriety, I've come to understand things a different way. Today, life for me is no longer a race for riches. It is about having people in my life who love me. And the best pathway to earn that love for me is to follow the ways of St. Francis. Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, and to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, and it is in pardoning that we are pardoned. It is in dying that we are born to eternal life. I would like to thank you folks for being here tonight and allowing me to be able to share my time with you, and hopefully it can help one person in this room. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
First I slipped, and then I quit. To a hope-filled dream. You rescued me. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise is. All is. Sometimes quickly. Sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, God walks by, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Take me.